What is up, everybody? It's your boy, Chad Sommer, here on Rock Bottoms Up Podcast. Today with us is Brenda Fox. Brenda Fox is a former board-certified art therapist who spent 21 years helping those in recovery, as well as women with eating disorders. Now, Brenda is an old-time artist. We are so excited to have Brenda here with us today. We're going to chat about what really goes down in the battle against addiction, how families cope, and what it takes to stay on the sober train. So kick back, everybody. Grab yourself a snack, because this episode will be packed with the experience and education to keep you on the recovery track. Now let's get real about addiction and recovery with Brenda. Brenda, why don't you start us off by getting to know you a little bit and go ahead and share with us a little bit about your life.
Well, hey, Chad, thank you so much for bringing me on. And I just want to say, first off, anybody who can see in recovery is a hero of mine. And I do have to say that, believe it or not, I have not come from a background of addiction. A grandfather of mine, who I never met, apparently was an alcoholic, though. So my mom was an adult child of an alcoholic. Mm. However, I wasn't around alcohol growing up. My dad drank, you know, a little bit socially. My mom never touched a drop in her life. And so when I was an art therapist, of course, my clients would call me the normie. But back in the day, as a kid growing up, I always loved art. And I always, oftentimes would have my friends, I guess I must have been a good listener. I must have had wisdom back in the day. I don't know. But, oh, my friends were, you should be a counselor. You should be a counselor. Well, I didn't want to be a counselor. I wanted to be an artist. I love film production, photography. I wanted to go that creative route. But, of course, my dad, who was only trying to watch out for me, he would say, Brenda, why do you want to be an artist? Like, you know, or I said, well, I want to be an art teacher, Dad. You know, we've got a line of teachers in our background. I want to be a teacher. I'm an art teacher. Well, why do you want to be an art teacher? They're going to be the first ones cut from the budget. And he didn't mean that in any kind of mean or ugly way. He was just trying to protect his daughter. And he goes, besides, why would you want, you know, you can't expect to sell your paintings out on a street corner. Well, Chad, get this. I now have my paintings in a gallery almost on a street corner in Scottsdale, Arizona. How crazy is that? I never saw that pump, honestly. So, yeah.
That is.
But I did get my degree I got a bachelor's degree or associate's degree in fine art, a bachelor's degree in film production and photography, and then eventually went on to get a master's degree in art therapy. So that's a little bit of my background story.
Wow. Yeah, that's really cool. I had no idea you had a little bit of background in film. I definitely could use you here on the show as I try to man my own camera. Brenda here was there earlier, and she was like, hey, maybe adjust this a little bit. So she was already showing some of her tech skills. Brenda, again, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here. Brenda's a good friend of me and Shauna's. We've known Brenda. She's been absolute delight. Brenda, let's start off with some questions. Sure. You talked about your background, you know, as an art therapist, what would you do and how would you work, with those in recovery?
That's a great question. People are usually very intrigued with what I did as an art therapist. And so one of the things that I might, have us do, either one-on-one or in a group therapy session, I would have, I'll say the guys, my customer, most of my clients were men, young men. I did have some women for a while too, but, so I might pose a question, and maybe this day we were going to be making masks. Okay. Mask making. So I would say, you know, If your addiction had a face, what would that look like? And my rules in my art room were, there's no mistakes in art, there's no right or wrong, and it doesn't have to be perfect, and it doesn't have to look like anything. And so I would have just the most creative masks coming out of my art room, and from very scary to just, you couldn't tell what it was, but basically the idea was to allow the client to be able to step back and really take all of that, all of those feelings, emotions, anger, whatever it might be, and put it into the mask making, put it into the artwork, you know? And so it was a way for them to kind of step back subjectively and look at this mask and talk about it and process their feelings and talk about what it is. Maybe it looked like a monster. So we would talk about a monster or a lizard or whatever it might have been, something satanic. Oftentimes, you know, I saw some pretty ugly masks. But the mask gave them then a platform for them to be able to talk about the addiction in a more subjective way and objective way, and allow for them. And then sometimes I might play with them. I'm like, well, you know, if your mask could talk, what would it say? And then he would say something, and then I said, what do you want to say back to it? And so there'd be this play, an interaction of play, of dialogue between the client and the mask and or the addiction. And, you know, sometimes after we'd get through the session, you know, be like, what do you want to do with this mask? And he's like, can I destroy it? I'm like, yeah, let's go outside. What do you want to do? You know, what do you want to, before you destroy it, what do you want to say? You know, and so he might stop by and he might take a big rock or something and say whatever he needed to say. But it was a way to release the tension, the emotion, that kind of thing. So mask making was definitely one of my favorite art therapy techniques to use with my clients.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine, you know, being able to kind of, you know, set your sight apart from the ugly, you know, and be able to project that, you know, those, it's almost like you're taking those feelings and you're able to take them outside of you and just, you know, put them in front of you. So it's not here anymore, but it's, you know, you're able to put it in front of you. And then, you know, being able to dispose of your mask however, you know, you wanted to, I can only imagine, you know, that relief, that feeling of almost release. You know,
the
ugly part that was in here, be able to express that and remove that from oneself. That had to have been really, really powerful for that individual to be able to.
Very much so.
I bet you've seen some pretty amazing transformations. With that, and it probably allowed that individual, you know, kind of in that demonstration, in the act of really be able to, it's almost like a process that now they can really kind of open up and begin to really talk about it. It's almost like it allowed them to break down a wall. So it this platform now to be able to speak from.
Exactly right. And I'm just thinking now, when I worked with the women with eating disorders, again, that's another kind of addiction, of course.
Yeah.
I worked at a Christian facility with the women, and there was a big, huge cross on the property. And oftentimes what I would do is, you know, maybe the women would journal about their mask or whatever they might have done or whatever, but then they wanted to give it up. They were ready to really give over their eating disorder and get into recovery. And so we'd take a walk down to the cross, and they would then lay this mask at the foot of the cross as if they were laying it at the foot of the cross of Jesus. So that was really powerful as well.
Yeah.
And again, another way for them to release in a physical sense, you know, and they have that then memory you know, of no, I put dad at the cross, you know, or my one of my guys might say, no, I smashed that thing. I smashed that sucker, you know, I'm done, you know. So again, the art really acts as a container, you know, if you will, kind of that emotional container in the paper or in the clay, if they're punching the clay or whatever it is that they're doing. It acts as a container to hold those emotions. And so I did family art therapy with the families. I did one-on-one, I did group, you know, I worked with hundreds and hundreds of clients in the recovery process as an art therapist. And of course I was able to do the talk therapy as well, but mostly, you know, the art therapy was just really so powerful.
No, I can definitely see why. Never experienced, you know, therapy like that. But let's say you're painting a wonderful picture. No, that's really cool. Also that you were able to get to, you know, to get to work with, you know, the families, because, you know, how powerful it would be, you know, to be able to create this safe place to where, you know, now the family can all work together as one, kind of, because kind of in the beginning, it was probably, I wouldn't say one against the family, because I'm assuming the majority of the families want the best for their kid, but it seems like there would be just maybe a little bit of separation, like I'm the one with the problem, you're not. But you know, in that setting, it kind of levels the playing ground and probably promotes you know, that feeling of being one working together. And you know, we're all in this together. We're, you know, we're going to work through this till the end. So I can imagine it, you know, I can imagine the work that you did in those rooms, how you were able to, you know, be able to work those families into, you know, that support that, you know, one needs in addiction.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, some family members are maybe more resistant, you know, sometimes, you know, family members would say, you know, why can't you just quit? Why don't you just stop? Just quit drinking, like walk away. Yeah, which is a really misconception of I think addiction. Oh, and some of the family members, you know, they enable some of the addict's behavior. You know. Yeah. So, but when you had a family that was willing to even look at their part in this family, because it's a family system, it's a family dynamic, whether it's eating disorders or a family, there's issues, there's dysfunction, there's something not going right in the family system that creates this monster called an addiction. You know, not that the person is a monster, no, the addiction in and of itself, you know, is a monster.
Yeah, good point. So as you know, as these individuals would come into the, you know, your facility, like, you know, the ones that were who were battling addiction, like what would you say typically leads an individual, you know, down that path, would you say?
My experience was that there's usually a lot of trauma, you know, unresolved trauma, maybe some childhood trauma, or just, my goodness, it can be multifaceted. You know, it can be an absent parent. It can be, you know, unfortunately, any kind of abuse, sexual abuse, emotional, physical abuse. They could have come from a very, you know, a parent or two could have been addicted themselves, you know, you know, maybe the dad was a workaholic and never around, and that's again another form of an addiction, right? But also, I, you know, some of the guys came in And I worked at a facility that was awesome. It was a 12-month program. And they were young adults. They were from age 18 to 25. We didn't take anybody older than that. And they were there for about a year. And it ended up being that these were higher end, more affluent families. So it wasn't like I was working with kind of your stereotypical drug addict on the street, which I hate to say that, but unfortunately our society says that. Now, mind you, some of these guys did land themselves on the street.
Yeah.
Okay. But some of the guys would come in and maybe they were football players or something and they had an injury. And they were given some oxys and some painkillers. And all of a sudden, oh my goodness, they loved that high. They loved that high. And they had no intention of becoming addicted.
Yeah.
And but then the more that you unpacked their, you know, the history of their family, maybe there was addiction in their family, maybe grandpa, grandma, somebody like that, maybe not the parents, but somebody along the way. So they, it kind of came from an addictive family line, if you will. And so now they love these oxys. They love getting high. They could lie. If it, oh, the pain is still there. Bam. Doctors give it out like candy.
Yeah.
I had one young man tell me, he came from Hollywood, Florida. I will never forget this. And it was in the height of the oxys and the painkillers and all of that stuff. And he told me that in Hollywood, Florida, these doctors were literally passing out these painkillers as if it were candy. And the elderly people who needed money would get that medication and sell these pills for $80 a pill.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, what do I know? I'm just the therapist. I don't know much. I learned so much from my men and women who were addicted. I learned so much from them, you know. And I live in Arizona, and the treatment center was here in Arizona, so I didn't know anything about Florida.
Yeah. No. Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's insane. I had one of my best friends, you know, you talk about the football player. Yeah, that was Ben's story. And I mean, like, honestly, how innocent, you know, how innocent,
yeah.
You know, because I mean, you're taking a pill that is, you know, it is prescribed. And it does what? It relieves that pain, but then there's that hook that not a lot of people realize can control your life pretty quick.
Yeah.
In a way that you become a slave now to that euphoric feeling.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah, those stories just, they just put me in awe as how innocent, you know, their walk to addiction, you know, was. Brenda, like, what do you think are some, like some common misconceptions people have about, you know, addiction recovery?
Yeah, I think again, from my experience, I think a lot of people are uneducated about addictions. And so a misconception could be, why can't you just stop? You know, just walk away. Use mind over matter. Mm-hmm. You know, I think those are probably some of the most obvious ones.
Yeah.
And yet I think every family in America, at least, has been affected by addiction of some sort. And so probably just, why can't you just stop?
Yeah.
You know, or just, you know, go get help, you know, whatever it might be, go get help, go to a 12 step. And yes, some people can begin their journey going to 12 step.
Yeah.
But the guys I was working with, oh my gosh, figure this. I mean, an 18-year-old kid or a 20-year-old kid, he had already been using for 10 years when he showed up usually in our treatment center.
Wow.
So, or if he was 25, right? He'd already been using since, so you're looking at age 8, 15, 12, young boys getting involved with the drugs. And so they came to us with already 10 years addicted. And I learned from one of the psychiatrists there, she told us that if someone has been in a, if someone's been using for 10 years, let's say, on a consistent daily basis, it will take at least 1 year to detox the body at a cellular level. 1 year. And these treatment programs are maybe 30 days.
Wow.
Are you kidding me?
That's crazy.
So it's insane. And so that's why people get triggered, because the brain is so addicted to this chemical. And that's the other thing, I think, is that the misconception is that people don't realize that the brain and the body actually gets addicted and all feels like it needs it in order to function, which is a lie. It's not true, but that's what's happening. And so to just say, oh, just forget, oh, just stop.
Yeah.
You know, it's so intense at a cellular level, you know, and it takes a year for your body to detox from the cells.
That's crazy. Just to get back to normality, you know.
Exactly right.
You know, the body, you know, producing those chemicals and, you know, getting, you know, that whole system to function, you know, properly without that, you know, without that, you know, that chemical.
Stimulus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, I did not know that. That's insane.
Insane.
But, I mean, it is. It is a misconception. And so if we would, you know, take, you know, the word drugs out of it and you know, switch it out for, like, say, Mountain Dew, you know, just a Mountain Dew drinker or pop drinker.
Oh, right? Yes.
Is somebody who's drink their pop all their life and go to them and just say, just stop, you know, just stop. Or a coffee drinker, just stop drinking pop, you know, coffee. I don't understand why you can't just stop.
Exactly.
You kind of see it in a different perspective when it's something that, you know, that you use, you know, you put it in perspective for people like that, you know, because they don't have the capability to really understand, you know, where this individual's coming from that, like you mentioned, that chemical standpoint and what a dependency it becomes on.
Yeah. And then think about, you know, if the person has unresolved trauma or grief or loss, you know, the emotional piece of it, right? The addict is going to take that substance and numb the pain.
Yeah.
So he or she wants to numb the pain of the emotional, you know, issues that aren't resolved. And so, you know, subconsciously, maybe the addict is thinking, well, I don't want to stop because that means all this pain is going to come to my, what am I going to do with this pain?
Yeah, those withdrawals. And then, you know, it's not just the physical withdrawals, you know, like you had mentioned, you know, some form of the trauma. So there's that deep underlining, you know, issue that needs to get, you know, resolved as well.
Exactly.
So, great point, Brenda, great point. So, with family and friends, can you discuss like their role in supporting someone, you know, through the journey of recovery from addiction?
Yeah. I would really encourage, and at least again, the treatment center I worked at, and I would still encourage this, and I still do. I would encourage the family members to get into their own recovery. And probably saying, Brenda, why? They're not addicted. Well, actually, they are addicted. It is called codependency. Because wherever there's an addict, there's a codependent. And so the codependent has his or her own issues. because the codependent wants to come and rescue and save, you know, this individual who's addicted. And what I've experienced is that, with, you know, say a mom who, you know, she's so invested in her son, an adult son, let's say, and maybe her life, but maybe her own life is boring. She doesn't have much meaning. Maybe she hates her job. Let's say that that's her life. And so she's throwing herself into her family and caring for her family, being a mama bear, doing what moms do. But because her life is so blah, let's say, she's going to go running to everything about her addicted son to help rescue and kowtow and, oh, honey, and oh, come home and this and that. And so this codependent wanting to fix the addict, and you can't fix the addict. And so much of that, I mean, so I would highly suggest parents going to, you know, Codependent No More group, a CODA group, an Al-Anon group. If teenagers, I'm going to an Alateen, you know, get yourself in recovery, grow in yourself, get into therapy yourself, because there's a reason why you're not allowing yourself to let go and set boundaries, you know. And that's another key thing I learned with working with addicted families, if you will, and men or women in addiction. I had to learn. I had to be tough. I had to let my yes be yes and my no be no.
Yeah.
And I really had to, like, in love, get in their face.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and in love, get in their face of the mom and dad. And even, you know, a good friend of mine, you know, we were in a small group, little Bible study together, and her son, adult son, had to go into treatment. And I would see my friend, you know, just, and I'm like, stop it, you know, and she respected me enough and I her enough. And I'm like, stop it. You've got to stop doing this, you know. And I also learned that the family members, they have been traumatized by the behavior of their loved one, their addict. You know, they have been traumatized, you know, and the person, you know, the client, if you will, you know, he or she may have childhood trauma or whatever. But then if they're out on the streets, there's traumatic things that happen out on the street, you know. So now they've got levels of trauma on top of other trauma that hasn't been dealt with. Okay, then you've got this trauma and this post-traumatic stress disorder. So many of the family members have PTSD.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
Because they're like, the phone rings and they're afraid it's going to be a police officer calling them and they're going to have a, you know, or there's, you know, the daughter's on the phone and I just got arrested, or, oh, my gosh, da-da-da, I just smashed my car. I mean, there's so much post-traumatic stress disorder happening in families. And so the family members have to sort of learn to separate themselves from their loved one. And work on themselves to be able to set boundaries and say no, and, you know, and come to a point where they can let go and let God,
amen,
you know, and let the consequences fall where they may for the person who is either in recovery or still using.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, and we would talk to the families bluntly and say, listen, if you don't get your codependency under wraps, that could kill your kid.
Good point.
Your behavior of trying to rescue him from his consequences until he hits a bottom. I mean, that's your show, right? Rock bottoms up.
Right.
That drug addict, until that alcoholic, you know, hits the bottom, forget it. Game over. Unless he wants to get in recovery and get better, nothing's going to happen. And same with the family members. The family members sometimes have to hit their own bottom and say, listen, you know, listen, Bobby, I love you and I can't live this way. No, I'm not letting you back in the house You're 37 years old. You're 25 years old. You're a grown man. You have got to get in recovery. I can't help you. I can't save you. I can't rescue you.
Yeah. And that's where those healthy boundaries, you know,
yeah,
can be applied. Because, you know, I've helped you 1,000 times before and you've never followed through on that, da, 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 da. You know, it's really important to, you know, strategize a little bit. So you're not enabling, but, you know, you're promoting these healthy boundaries that, you know, that are good for, you know, that family or friend. And, you know, that can be a way to, for that addict to, you know, start making steps in their own life to start taking responsibility. So important.
Yeah, exactly.
And Brenda, like sharing those other help agencies, I'll have to write those down and make those accessible for our viewers, because that'd be them the means to be able to, you know, get that help, because they do need help. You had mentioned, you know, that mom waiting for that phone call. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because, you know, my mom, mom, you know, if you're watching the episode, we're going to refer you to a couple of these agencies that you might want to look into and read into a little bit, because I think it'll help you. But my mom, I said this on my podcast the other day, because I apologized to my mom, but I was second guessing, did I really apologize to my mom? You know, it's one thing to, like, you know what you've done is wrong and you quickly say you're sorry, but, you know, did you really mean it? And, you know, I was lying in bed one night and I just called her up and, you know, sat through the phone call and just cried to her, told her how much I loved her and, you know, how much she helped with my kids during this time. And her response to me was, you know, I'm just glad you're safe. Because, you know, she was on that end of, she was afraid, was this the night that, you know, my son gets arrested or, you know, ODs.
Yeah. Right.
And so, you know, family, friends out there who are dealing with an addict, Brenda just made some great referrals to some programs that really will give you some answers and help, you know, be able to help yourself through this hard time, watching, you know, your loved ones spiral out of control. Thanks for sharing that, Brenda. That was really good. Brenda, what are some coping mechanisms or strategies you found effective for individuals trying to maintain their sobriety?
Yeah, and it's a good question. Now, again, the guys and gals that came to our facility, they were there for 12 months. And from there, we had a step down program and they would go into sober living for about 6 months. Again, I don't know of any other treatment centers out there anymore that are a year long, you know. Obviously, sober living houses can be really good, you know, going into a 30 or 60 day, you know, treatment center, can be a good step. Obviously, I truly believe in the 12 steps of AA and I think it's Naranon and, you know, whatever it is, a 12 step program, and getting a sponsor, working the steps, all of those are great. It's such a great platform to really look at yourself and take responsibility, like you said, and finding a good therapist as well can help. I would encourage people to stay away from, so many of the guys and gals came from out of state here to Arizona, and a lot of them never went back home because going back home meant going back into the territory that would trigger them. And before you knew it, friends are knocking on the door and pulling you out, you know. So coping skills and knowing what your triggers are, working your 12 steps. Go find a hobby, you know, go find something that you love to do. Go learn a new way of having fun, you know, and any kind of person I've ever met who's in recovery, who's an addict, are extremely creative people, extremely talented, extremely creative, extremely spiritual, extremely sensitive human beings. Yeah. And so find other ways that bring you joy. You know, if you're an artist or work with your hands or, you know, get into sports or whatever it might be, find something that's fun and be around people in sobriety who are supporting you in sobriety. You know, find some normie friends, you know, so you're not just necessarily in with a bunch of guys in recovery, even though that could be great, you know. Stay away from the guys that are into war sharing. I mean, get out of that stuff. You know, you got to change your perspective. You got to change your location, your territory. Got to change it up, you know. So those are just some things that come to my mind.
Yeah, no, so good. So good, Brenda. You know, as an addict, you know, 24 hours a day would be dedicated sometimes to, you know, to our addiction. And so you really have to find, you know, something to substitute that time you were doing drugs. You have to find something to keep you busy.
Right.
And, you know, those who are just starting off in their recovery, it's really important that you find these healthy avenues. And I would suggest, since you're just starting in recovery, you know, an AA program is good to get involved in. They have a lot of service projects and things that, you know, allow you to feel those times. Plus, you know, you are building those relationships with, you know, making those friendships with those who are in recovery. But just like Brenda had mentioned, you know, you don't want just a wrench in your tool bag. You want a bunch of tools in your tool bag. You know, it will make you more successful in working towards staying sober, because, you know, you'll always want that plan B, that plan C, that plan D, just in case you get bored. Something as simple as boredom triggers drug use, because when we get bored, what would we do? We would run to our addiction to feel that, just being bored. So, right. So important for you to step outside of yourself and even try things you've never tried before. What a great opportunity in life to be able to do that. And hey, you might find a new hobby you didn't know you could do that you absolutely love and are good at, you know. And so thank you for that, Brenda. That was awesome. And so well needed.
Something I would tell my clients, you know, it's like, I'm like, dude, think about how much time you spent on getting your high. It was just like what you said. And I said, imagine taking that energy. And if you turned it around and took that much energy and put it into your recovery, what would your life look like? I'm like, dude, you could be president. Mm. You could be president of a company, United States. Oh, there's a lot of corruption there. I wouldn't go there. But anyhow, I mean, you know, but I'm like, what if you took all that energy and really put it into all that energy, put it into your recovery, it could change the world around you.
Mm.
Because again, the creativity, the sensitivity, you know, unless he's a full-blown narcissist, the love for people. I mean, I have found men and women in recovery. They want to help. They want to help their brother and sister struggling.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, and if they find God, and I know that AA talks about God as you know him, mm-hmm. or as you, whatever, yeah. you know, you know, can help, because it really is a spiritual issue. It's a spiritual issue. You know, the drug has become their God. That's what they worship,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, but man, if you take that energy and turn it into your recovery and find that hobby that could then be turned into an amazing career.
Yes.
Wow. Look out.
Yeah, no, that's a great point that you make, Brenda. That's a great point, because we do, we spend all that time, and if you could just take that time you were spending in your addiction and just invest in yourself. Yeah. Invest in little things like hygiene, just getting into the rhythm of taking care of your body, eating right, you know, make sure you're getting the right substances, you know, health-wise for your body to, I mean, obviously, like Brenda had mentioned, the whole year, just for your body to reset itself, how important it is to take care of your hygiene and make sure you're getting the right nutrition as you detox, you know, from years and years of substance abuse. Brenda, you are so amazing, my friend, with your experience and knowledge and the information that you have shared here today, and just given us a different perspective on how, you know, addicts can, you know, seek help and you know, through, like you said, or like you did for 21 years. You know, I never had heard of art therapy before, but as you explain it, you know, you can really see how it can help an individual in their addiction. And so, guys, you're out there struggling, and you've done everything from left to right and everything in between. Here's another one for you. You know, if everything you've thrown at the wall has not stuck, art therapy. And you can see why that would allow an individual to really decompress and get to the root of the issues, and creating a safe place for them to process everything, enabling them, giving them the opportunity to really bring it back in and really form a way of executing how you're going to not just you know, be sober, but sustain that for long periods of time. Brenda, as we come to the end of this wonderful conversation, is there anything that you would like to leave with us? Any last thoughts, Brenda?
Oh, well, again, thank you, Chad, for letting me share about this. I've been out of the industry now for eight years, because as a clinician, I was the one that got burned out. And so if there's any clinicians out there listening too, you know, it's so important for the clinician to take care of his or her mental health as well, you know. And I would say, again, there's hope. There's hope out there. There's programs, Al-Anon, you know, Alateen, yeah. CODA groups, AA, Nar-Anon for Narcotics Anonymous. There are therapists out there who specifically, you know, they specialize in addiction treatment. And if you're struggling with trauma, flashbacks, PTSD, there are amazing therapists out there who do EMDR, which is another form of working through trauma. And then go find some of the things that bring you joy, because there's hope. And I shared with you earlier offline, Chad, that there are a few former clients that I've been able to stay in touch with. And, you know, 13, 14 years in sobriety. And I mean, they're one of my biggest heroes. And one man is now married with a wife, two kids, working a farm. I mean, and he's a number, you know, he's like this gold medal jujitsu fighter, you know, and he just, but that's what he did. You know, he took that energy. He took all of that stuff and he put it into fighting and jujitsu. He's gold medal. You know, I'm so proud of him, you know. So there's hope. There's always hope. And, you know, get back into church. If that's your connection with God, find that 12-step group. And I keep listening to Chad and on him. Great. Awesome. And, you know, podcasts, this is what you're doing, Chad. You know, you found something that you love. You found your voice and you're finding something. You're giving back. You're giving back to your, the people who are struggling in addiction. Look what you're doing. I mean, this is awesome.
Yeah.
So good, Chad.
Thank you, Brenda. I appreciate that. And too, like, you know, like you had mentioned, it's so important to be able to, you know, find places, you know, to put that extra time in. As you mentioned with that, you know, with that, past client, jujitsu. I mean, that's one that will really eat your time if you let it. You know, because, you know, it's not just the practicing and the art form. It's, you know, competitive. So you've got, you know, you've got this huge system that allow you to, you know, to continue to stay active. And it will definitely eat up your time if you let it.
Yeah.
And church, you mentioned. Church is a great, it's another great, you know, organization that you can get involved with. There's plenty brothers and sisters out there who are not, you know, having to deal with addiction, but can use service in one way or another. So you can, you can donate your time to, you know, these service groups, service to your church, or, you know, go to a retirement home. They will love to have you come in and just sit and play checkers with somebody. Honestly, just go in and ask permission, and how rewarding is that to be able to, you know, entertain somebody who, you know, day in, day out, same thing every day, you know, and we're able to give them a little bit of light and a little bit of color in their life.
Yeah.
Well, Brenda, you've been an absolute treat today.
Thank you.
You are so sweet. And I sure do. I, you know, you being on here really has given, you know, us addicts another tool to put in, you know, our tool bag. And that's what it's all about, is being able to create a community and to create other tools. So, you know, we can walk this road together, and that we have, you know, we have what we need to sustain sobriety. So thanks again, Brenda. Guys, that is a wrap today here on Rock Bottoms Up. A huge shout out to our amazing guest, Brenda, for sharing her individual wisdom and experience with us. Her insights have lit a fire of inspiration in all of us. I know in me, it was amazing to learn something new today, to be able to share with those suffering still in their addictions, be able to provide them another tool for their tool bag. Just remember, folks, no matter how tough the road gets, there's always a glimmer of hope waiting for us. Let's keep lifting each other up, supporting one another, and striving for a brighter tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, keep pushing forward. Keep staying strong and keep holding on, because you are worth it and deserve it. Peace out, everybody.